Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With a stupid Ewok head.
Blah blah on him, Nolsey.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
A total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker. Gary Wilmot.
Okay.
Sue Cook.
Okay.
Dale Winton.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where the journey of 160 miles begins with a single footstep. We're working our way through Nomad, and I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Nightly buggery marathons.
Nick Alder.
Wow, security guards really are terrible at figurative speech.
And Tom Stab.
Infinity, the final frontier.
So, news. I hand the baton over to Nick, who has gone into the next four chapters in deep depth.
So, can we just ask Nick how nervous he is?
Very nervous to take the baton from Adam. Although, couldn't help but notice your hand was shaking as you gave it to me, Adam. Nervous that I'm going to show you up.
Unlikely.
Right, let's get started. Who's got something?
Just a bit of fun.
Just a bit of fun. Seriously, I should start.
No, really, do you have anything?
Should I start? I'm going to go now. Jed, anything? Thumbs up from Jed, we can start.
We're recording.
Okay, we've got the thumbs up. I thought I'd start with some overall highlights. This is across both of my chapters, but there were some things that I just pulled out that...
Both of your chapters?
Well, across both of my parts.
So we're dividing across the eight chapters.
Okay, so across the eight chapters, these are some of my highlights. So when Adam gets hide and seek, Rob calls it hide and be seek.
Adam.
Did I call him Adam again?
Adam Partridge. Alan Partridge.
Alan.
My name is Alan.
Nick, we're off to a great start. Let's keep going.
Bums back instead of bum bag. The dated references to Darren Day, Samantha Fox and Lloyd Grossman. The word ace soccer save. The term love you, Aim. To infinity, the final frontier. Acting the big man on campsite. Hey, my assistant's name and yes. and a ruck bag.
Yeah, I love that. Hey, my assistant's name. That's one of my favourites.
Yep.
So, chapter 9, the journey of 160 miles begins with a single footstep.
Quite poetic from Alan, I feel.
Yeah,
there.
I can tell that he thinks it's profound, but it is just what happens, isn't it?
Yeah. Dumb. So Alan is on his way and, in his words, making good progress. There's a gag here about Denise and Fernando. Did anyone actually fall for this and think that at any point Denise and Fernando were in any way with him or participating in the walk?
No.
Not really. I mean, the first mention of Fernando is Fernando has picked up some glass or a bit of grit and is clanking audibly. So, I mean, you know immediately it's not actual Fernando.
I was traveling when listening to this, and I kind of maybe zoned out for literally like 10 or 12 seconds or something like that, and when I realized what he was actually saying, I was like, hang on, what is going on? I thought it might have been a dream of some sort. I knew it obviously wasn't reality, but I wasn't particularly sure what was happening, so I was going, oh, this must be a dream of some sort. Yeah. Or something.
I was thinking, do we think that Alan will see this as a kind of, you know, a sort of a touching gesture, like it's a nice thing to do for your children to name your shoes as like my two children are the very things I pound into the floor each day for 8 hours. Like, but he's seen it as like, wow, what a thing to do. Like, I'll name my shoes after my kids.
And then also very much sort of blaming Fernando the shoe for picking up glass as if it's the shoe's fault.
My other highlights included Fernando's mind being warped by puberty. Is such a thing possible? Are teenagers' minds warped by puberty?
I think in Alan's viewpoint, it's not hormones or anything like that. It's like their minds are being warped. They're going through like a brain change rather than kind of like hormonal or chemical changes.
Yeah. And crucially, of course, Carol. So yeah. His mind is warped by puberty and Carol. Carol being their mum, their maternal mum.
I like, as is his want, Denise very much second in the pecking order. Yes. When it comes to descriptions, and also probably described in less favourable terms than Fernando.
But that's Denise. She can be a cold fish unless she's drunk.
Do we think that that's some kind of reference to Denise potentially having some kind of drink problem or not?
Well, it's always been hinted at that she's a bit of a free spirit.
Yes, bit of a wild card.
Yeah. Change, that's a bad attitude. Yeah. I mean, the picture that emerges of Denise is, the way that she's described by Alan, you would think that she was kind of quite off the rails, very out of control. But I think really it's just that she is a woman who does not care about Alan that much. Yeah.
And won't be kept to a very long list. Yeah.
It's kind of like when you've got like a friend of your parents and they're like, oh, I saw someone the other day and he's really gone off the rails. And it turns out all that's happened is he's had his nose pierced and got a tattoo.
Yeah.
But it's like, in Alan's mind, probably fairly small alternative moves from Denise are kind of wildly outside the norm.
Yeah, I was also very much troubled by the line, forced my feet into their gaping mouths. Although in Alan's mind, they're very happy about this with him kind of projecting on them by saying, thanks, Dad. Thanks for the foot pops.
Do you think there's also a bit of intentional tone deafness in the fact that when he's walking along with some glass in his shoe, the way that he's chosen to write this down is the same as a racial slur?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I think he's done that out of a sort of a kind of, what's the word, like just an ignorance.
Yes.
That you wouldn't, you didn't ought to have used that phrasing.
Because I guess it's kind of like a onomatopoeic thing, but anybody else would go, I'll rewrite that to something differently.
Exactly.
Because they'd be a bit more in touch with the times.
Yeah.
I do think you get some nice lines in here. So the fact that they use the line, a shiny brass hat and a one-toothed shark for essentially the fact that a pin has gone into the bottom of his shoe. And that's all it is.
A nice bit of redundant information as well, where he says, I've named my walking boots Fernando and Denise after my children, Fernando and Denise.
Yeah, that's basically the payoff for that joke. Again, it's one of those, like, it's just trivial information for, you know, how many hundreds of words for the ultimate payoff that, you know, he's named his shoes Denise and Fernando after his children, Denise and Fernando.
When he says, I jemmy the pin out and throw it into a hedge, shouldn't that be Jimmy? I always thought it was Jimmy.
But is that the joke?
Yeah. Is that the joke?
Yeah. I think that's the joke.
So, yeah.
It was either that's the joke or it's always been Jimmy and I've got this wrong, like bow and arrow.
a Jim bow and arrow.
So this is essentially Alan walking to his home in 12 Cecil Road. He recognises that his address has not been seared into the public consciousness, such as 10 and 12 Downing Street and the address of Sherlock Holmes, which he himself does not reference.
Yep.
Does anyone know where Sherlock Holmes lives?
Is it 229B?
No.
Baker Street?
Well, it's on Baker Street, yes, but you've got the number wrong.
It's 22 something B, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, but I need the complete number.
221B.
Correct.
I saw Jed motion it. Okay. I cheated.
I'm living a few doors down.
Isn't there an extra gag about he's previously... I can't remember exactly what it was, but there's something where he's previously talked about how much he loves Sherlock Holmes, like he's read every book, but if that was true, he would know the address of where he lives.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, we find out that Alan's mum has very clear views on Holmes and Watson being gay lovers, with an overly detailed analysis of their gay life, which, to be clear, is not documented anywhere in the books.
No, it's just her theories.
It's just her theory.
I think it's absolutely brilliant because this bit goes on for far too long.
Yes, way too long.
Absolutely crashes through the taste barrier, and it's very funny.
Well, there's a podcast that is dedicated entirely to the subject of are Holmes and Watson gay,
like a fan fiction podcast.
Well, it's only an episode, to be fair, right. But it's part of the Decoder Ring podcast. So if you want to go and look that up, it's available wherever you get your podcasts, and they do speculate on the theory as to whether Holmes and Watson were gay.
So that probably is quite a common. There probably is a lot of fan fiction about that. I would imagine. Maybe Alan's mum was the first Holmes and Watson fan fiction writer?
Quite possibly.
I mean, we won't necessarily go into all the description of what Holmes and Watson get up to.
I think we should do some, though.
Regular heroin consumption, which kind of fuels their homosexual lifestyle, nightly buggery marathons. There's actually a little detail that is in the audiobook that isn't in the in the written version of Nomad. The line from Nomad is Alan saying, "Mother was left in little doubt that the reason Holmes seemed to lack compassion as he stood over the body of the story's latest murder victim was because he was too busy salivating at the prospect of what Watson was going to do to him that night." Now that's in the book, and then there's a little line in the that's added in the audiobook, which is, "She also believes Holmes snorted cocaine off Watson's backside." Again, just a little thing that is added in by Coogan in the audiobook that doesn't appear in the written
version.
And
it seems like she's developed this theory in order to basically disapprove and be homophobic about it. It's not like you would think someone that's gone to these lengths would do it because she actually wants them to be gay lovers and thinks that's a good thing, whereas she's come up with this elaborate thing just so she can be like,
Alan, it's disgusting, and let me tell you more about it. I did enjoy as well, theirs was a relationship in which nothing was off the table. And the bit where he writes, "It seems hard to believe that the landlady wouldn't at least have noticed a thud of Holmes's body as it hit the floor, unconscious once again, thanks to an over-tightened ball gag."
Once again! Mrs. Hudson is complicit in this gay relationship.
Absolutely.
We get a little further insight into Alan's early childhood and his relationship with his parents, where he would play the popular children's game Hide and Be Seeked, or as I called it as a child, Hide and Seek. Not sure if anyone else called it Hide and Be Seeked.
I think that's the joke.
Yeah, that's the joke. It turns out that Alan's parents would basically go looking for him in the cinema, obviously.
That's so good.
The joke being that they weren't playing with him and they would just let him hide and they wouldn't want to interact
Alan,
with him.
Go over there. We'll try and find you back in about 3 hours.
So is this, baby Alan being neglected, or is this a false narration and his parents weren't actually this bad?
I suspect that he probably hid and then they looked for him. They couldn't find him because he's very good at it. And then they would call out, Alan, please, the game's over. We need to go. We've got other things to do. And he refused to come out. And eventually, I think they just lost patience. So, I mean, yeah, they possibly were slightly neglectful, but it was certainly through his antagonism that they got there.
I think that it could be an interesting mix for this, because you've definitely got the unreliable narrator and his whole thing about the hard upbringing, yep, literary tropes. Yep. Which I think are definitely embellished. So, it could be a bit of both, I guess.
Yeah. And we arrive at Cecil Road to find out that the house has been yanked down and made way for a business park.
Well, as we know in real life, 12 Cecil Road is very much
alive
erect.
And well. Mm. Very much erect.
Like Holmes and Watson.
Yeah. Alan is delighted when he finds out that it's the regional headquarters of Carve Home Warehouse, instead of being something which arguably could have been more useful, such as a leisure centre or a playground.
I can absolutely imagine him trying to use this tidbit of information to negotiate a discount on some sort of iPhone or cup holder. From the Carphone warehouse.
Well, like, my house used to be here, please can I have a free hands-free car kit?
I mean, he's got a pretty enthusiastic approach to getting freebies and what he'll do in return for them. Look at the Kia in Alpha Papa, etc.
The new complex covers a large area, and Alan is intrigued to see which bit of the organisation now calls his home its home. He says he would love it to be the office of one of the senior management guys, but has to accept the possibility that it may just be the men's toilets or the desk of someone in the social media team.
That is brilliant. An absolute put down for anyone that works on a social media team.
Hello.
Yeah, equating it to shitting, basically.
Yeah.
It's really hard to tell the difference.
Alan is obviously keen to get into the building because he wants to start from the very exact point that his house stood. However, Stu, the security guard, is having absolutely none of it. Alan literally resorting to just picking names out of the air in the hope that someone with that name works in the building. But Stu, seeing through it, is not having any of it. This gets to such a ridiculous point that Alan basically ends up having a 5-minute candle vigil in Stu's little office, to the point where Stu literally can't get past him, even when he needs to fulfill the roles of his job.
Or even when he's busy letting off.
Mm. Yeah. A couple of nice notes as well. He slides in very late once he's been trying to find people that work there for ages, but he's gone on there on a Saturday and that's why there's nobody there.
Yeah.
So it was doomed to failure. I also thought it was quite good that all of the names that he guesses that there might be someone there are all very much kind of baby boomer, like people's mum's names, Sandra, Janet, Judith, etc. Like they're all very much, you know, he's going after names of people from his age group, basically.
And I like the fact with Judith, I think it turns out there are three Judiths there. Two of them aren't at work because it's Saturday, whilst the other is a workflow manager. And I don't think she can help me because I don't know what that is.
Brilliant. Little question to the group. Has anyone sort of gone and visited an old place where they've lived just to see like if anything's changed, or, you know, just to see, you know, if the area's changed at all? Like I quite recently, just because I happened to be in the area, walked past one of my old houses when I was a student, hoping that someone might pop out and I could have a little chat with. But you see it sometimes in TV shows where people go, oh, I used to live here. Can I come in and have a look? No, obviously not. But I was wondering if anyone's been to and visited any old haunts.
Went back to my old house in London a few weeks ago, mainly just to make sure that the woman who used to shout out of her window over the road had moved. It does seem that she's moved on. So
was she the one who shouted at you about having a barbecue?
No, that's
that was in
one.
Bristol.
Yeah, no,
it?
I incense middle-aged women wherever I live.
I can see one consistency.
There's a pattern forming. There's a pattern forming.
Whether I'm having a barbecue or just trying to get on with my life.
There is something about this chapter which I really enjoyed, which just to skip back ever so slightly, because I think this is absolutely brilliant and I think ties in with quite a good theme that follows throughout Nomad. You have a bit where Alan talks about imagining John Travolta, because he's imagining Travolta as he is now, in a kimono and underpants, walking the same walk in a hotel suite, his eyes fixed on the terrified intern he's instructed to watch him. I snap out of it. That's the thing with imagining. You can't always choose where it leads.
I mean, you literally can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, that in itself is a joke, but I like this fact that Alan actually, he can't control his imagination, or his imagination always leads him down dark paths that he wishes he didn't go down, and they're often quite homoerotic, and I think there are quite a few instances throughout Nomad where that happens.
Or in I'm Alan Partridge, when he's lap dancing for Tony Hayes, just saying that he's not in control of that scenario, he can't not imagine it, is what you're saying. Mm. Or that's what he's saying.
He doesn't believe he's in control of it, but it's basically a part of him has led him there.
He wishes his mind didn't take him there, but it does.
I also like the idea that, I know it's fantasy, but John Travolta employing an intern just to watch him.
Yeah.
Watch him do what?
So he's always being in a kimono.
I think it might be bad things.
Oh God.
Bad and wrong.
Bad and wrong.
Bad and wrong. Yes. So on to chapter 10. And I'm on my way. And we are going to throw to Tom Dark, who has compiled a chapter by chapter, where applicable, update on how many miles Alan has covered. So, Tom, over to you.
Yep. Thanks, Nick. I've broken this down day by day. So, chapter 10 is day one of Alan's walk. He will cover.
It's taken 10 chapters.
I know. A third of the book before he starts to walk. Brilliant. He will go from Cecil Road to Newton Flotsam, and he will cover a distance of 6 miles in day one.
Day.
That's day one, 6 miles.
He has got a heavy ruck bag, to be fair.
At this point, yes.
Yeah. So at this point, we find out that Alan prides himself on his ability to recognise car horns, excluding lorries. He refers to it as a skill. I don't know how many other people would have this skill in terms of recognising car horns. He's also imagined this into a game show format hosted by Darren Day, where the grand prize for the game show, if you win it, is a tracker bar.
And again, in his imagination, he doesn't even win the quiz show that he's imagining.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's not a fresh tracker bar. It's one that's been stored in his bum's bag.
Yeah. But Alan does get the last laugh here by letting Darren very much know that he does own the format. So he's very much the real winner.
I own the format, mate. Yeah.
Did you not enjoy that Alan thinks each car horn is as unique and special as a human fingerprint or a doggy's woof? Mm-hmm. Shep loves it too, Mum.
The game show he obviously imagined being presented by Darren Day. Just a quick Darren Day update for anyone who's wondering where he is. My folks went on a cruise recently and he was performing on board. Just thought I'd let you know.
Thanks for letting us know.
That's our new regular feature. Where's Darren Day today?
Yeah. Darren today? No? Anyone?
Yeah, if you like.
Yeah, sure.
Let's move on.
Yeah, okay. I mean, basically, Alan has... throughout that kind of the next few pages, like Alan is basically walking in the road, which is why we're kind of getting these car horns. So Alan is kind of like subliminally thinking about car horns, priding himself on the fact that he's got this ability to recognize them. But it becomes clear that he's basically just meandering into the road.
And I will say, I have read chapter one of Watling Street and he's also walking down the middle of a road.
Oh, really?
Coincidence?
Ah. I think not.
I like that the this car horn equivalent of a 21 gun salute has warmed the cockerels of his heart. I presume he means cockles.
Yeah.
He also salutes the fine people of Norwich. I found this a bit baffling, to be honest. He just sort of says if they were a cheese, they'd be Tesco finest cheddar. But I'm not...
Well, it's even worse than that. Yeah, if they were cheddar, they'd be Tesco finest cheddar.
I don't really understand that. I was trying to connect the dots as to what this all meant, but I didn't really get anywhere with it.
The best I've got here is that he's saying that they're really good people, and the best cheddar he can imagine is Tesco finest cheddar.
It's a bit like what's the best thing, isn't it?
The best of the Beatles, etc. So yeah, it becomes clear Alan's just walking in the road, so people start yelling out, "What are you up to, Alan? Where are you headed to, Alan? Why are you walking in the fucking road, Alan?"
Very good.
That is a lift from the audiobook. That is the way that Alan reads it. Much like the cheese explanation, I don't really understand why Alan pretends to be congenitally blind, which is why he's walking in the road.
Yes, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
A good mental image, and I'd be lying if I didn't smirk while, you know, whilst reading it. And yes, it's funny, and yes, it provides a reason to explain why he's walking in the road, but I don't really understand it, and I can't really put any flesh on the bones as to why he's doing it other than reporting the facts as I see them. Anyone else got anything?
No, I think you've. I think that's as much coverage as we can give it. Really, it's a bit of a contrived conceit to get him walking in traffic, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, again, a recurrent thing that we've heard around Alan supposedly loving walking. At this point, much as we've heard before, we hear that Alan doesn't even seem to enjoy walking, and the only people that should be walking in the road are people whose cars are broken down and sex workers. Which I've put like, you know, why should sex workers be on the road? I don't understand.
Got to get their business somehow.
Yeah, or those following in the footsteps of their father, which obviously he is.
He also said, yeah, he says it's the only, those are the only reasons a person should be travelling on foot next to a carriageway. So he's contradicting the Alan of I'm Alan Partridge, where he basically walks next to a carriageway to go and get his windscreen washer fluid.
Goldfinger!
That's what he's singing.
We've all seen it.
It's at this point that we get a bit of an English lesson around the use of intonation, much misused by Lloyd Grossman, which I did enjoy. For anyone that remembers Lloyd Grossman when he was on MasterChef, I can certainly remember him taking diabolical liberties.
Hello, and welcome to MasterChef.
And Through the Keyhole, let's not forget.
Hello, and welcome to Through the Keyhole.
Who would live in a house like this?
So,
where's he from? Is he Canadian?
I think now he's just smashing the pasta gravy sauces, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Although we were having a chat at work about these. This is a complete...
Tell us more.
Not in my notes.
Crazy times at your work.
These are off notes now. We're just saying that they are a bit pricey. Anyone agree? Just a bit pricey.
I don't think I've ever looked.
This is great chat.
Just really good chat.
I mean, to be honest, when I go looking for a pasta gravy sauce, an endorsement from the man who used to do Through the Keyhole is not really driving me.
Well, that's what I'm looking for personally in my pasta sauce choices.
Although the one food endorsement I would back is Ainsley Harriet Couscous.
Absolutely. I completely back you on that.
Sorry, is that a real thing?
Yeah,
it's good. Very much so. What?
Staggering.
It's good. Literally, just put it in a bowl.
Hello, Jill.
What next? Richard Madeley's fungal foot powder.
Alan basically tries to educate the reader on the use of intonation, and he uses an example with the lines, "Thanks very much." So what we're going to do now is just go around the group reading out the different emphasis on different lines in that, which is as follows. The following, which is
perfectly explained.
Achieving. Okay.
So I'm going to start. So thanks very much.
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 I mean, that's covered it.
That is it, basically.
How was that for you?
Oh, I mean, that was really good. That was it for everyone else.
That was quite powerful.
I do like that Alan suggests that the reader might be shaking at this point once they've grasped the concept of intonation. Or if you're
quick
sitting...
check.
Christ.
Yeah, no, yeah. Tom shaking a lot.
I think we can all agree that our initial scepticism has given way to a sense of awe because the true possibilities of the English language has unfurled before our very eyes.
I like that he describes people who might be crowded in public transport and chose not to say them aloud. They lack class and are assholes.
At this point, Alan is worried about the height and weight of his bag, although we do get a nice little segue into a story where he tried to give Eamon Holmes a fire lift back to his car, but his knees buckled before he even got off.
We even climbed on. Oh yeah, so the thing about the rucksack, Alan says it's stuffed full of kit and protruding a clear foot above his head.
A beautiful detail about Lynn here as well. He says he doubts her internet research because she once was caught raising her hand when she wanted to make a bid on an eBay auction.
Brilliant.
I love those sort of things about Lynn, about asking Jeeves and all that stuff. It's so good.
It's the end of day one and Alan has arrived at Newton Flockman. He is already, in his words, a few miles behind where he should be, but he's convinced he can make this up. So as Tom's already mentioned, he's kind of falling behind where he needs to be. Even though his bag is heavy at this point, his progress only kind of gets worse. So it's at this point that he needs to kind of set up the tent, which is only his bag, but Lynn has obviously packed his bag. But Kel surprise, there is an error here where Lynn has misunderstood Alan's packing instructions, which essentially he's put things in a numerical list, which Lynn has then packed at the bottom of the bag, whereas Alan expected them to be at the top. It's a completely innocent mistake, and whilst it's going to take about 15 minutes for Alan to get the tent out of his bag, he's just not prepared to invest that much time to get it out.
I think Alan is in the wrong here.
I think the point is, either way, the error could be interpreted on either person's part, but the fact that by his own admission, it would take a maximum of 15 minutes to get the tent out of his bag,
he's
not prepared to do that.
I would agree, Alan is in the wrong because he could have just bloody packed the bag himself.
Yeah. There's also a little trend developing here where he, on the promise, or not even a promise, of a TV show or some lucrative work, has basically spunked loads of money on expenses, hoping to claim it back. The 12 grand on the design consultancy that he then refused to pay, now £699.99 on a tent made to withstand Arctic winds, but he's only going to Dungeness power station. It's kind of like when he bought the 5-bedroom bastard house.
And I like that the South African shop assistant did tell him it was overkill for a truck in the UK, but he'd gone ahead anyway because I'm just that kind of guy.
No, so a far better idea in trying to set up the tent that he spent all that money on is to go to see an old acquaintance. It's Tony Cloak, of course, someone we've never heard of before. Nope. But he knocks on Tony's door and he's got a lot more hair than he remembers. So does anyone want to talk us through the exchange when he knocks on Tony Cloak's door?
Yep, it's absolutely brilliant. It's one of my favourite bits of this section. Alan? And then Alan, hello, Tony, long time, no text. Tony, you still owe me £3 grand, you prick.
Also great that the premise of him going to Tony Cloak's door is he says he lives right here in Newton Flotman. I shall borrow a tent from him. Well, I mean, he could just stay with him as well.
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, I guess at this point, though, he's probably trying to remain faithful to the walk. So he wants to sleep outside in the tent because it is like the first night. So if he falls
then,
the first night.
I guess he needs the tent for future dates as well. It's not just about tonight's lodging.
But at no point when he's laid out the footsteps of his father walk, because he said that he has to camp or anything like that. There are no extra rules.
He can't even remember why he has to walk.
Exactly.
And he hates walking, remember?
Yeah.
He
doesn't boring.
Like and owns two cars.
Yeah.
So it turns out that Alan has rear-ended Tony's car. Just to be even more clear, he means the car re-ended Tony's car. And then it cuts basically to, long story short, he gets the tent. He says, forget about the car smash. He needs to borrow a tent. Tony says sure, and then he says, I've condensed our conversation to cut out the bits that aren't relevant, but in brief, we restarted our positions vis-a-vis the accident. He grabbed me by the throat, I smashed him in the balls, he tried to roundhouse me but couldn't, he's 56, we realised this was stupid, hugged again, did high fives, hugged again, cup of tea, slice of cake, borrowed tent, hug for the road, walked away.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Did that actually happen, do we reckon?
It's quite honest.
I like the idea that it's something that is a very truthful blow-for-blow account, he's actually condensed, and then you get a really detailed analysis of something that may not have happened.
Yeah, yeah. And also it continues his sort of lifestyle choice of associating with emotionally volatile people, be it Michael or, you know, there's countless people through the history of Alan that basically the only reason they tolerate him is because they themselves have a part missing.
There's also a brief description about Tony that Alan gives, which I really like. He says, a man who can't eat a sandwich without his front teeth ending up looking like they're wearing gloves made of chewed bread. Oh. A delightful description.
So he's on his way to put up Tony's massive tent, he goes onto a bowling green, then basically starts to daydream, of course. He imagines himself as a bowling ball. He says, I'd roll around the glass, round and round, until with a gentle clack, I'd bump into a smaller white ball. Hello, I'd say, I'm black. Hello, the white ball would say, I'm white. And then in unison, we'd say, and that's just fine. At the time, I'd been listening to Ebony and Ivory a lot.
Nice. Yes, Alan attempts to make an erection with Tony's tent, which is obviously massive and does at one point involve him crying. It takes him about 4 hours and then he basically finds a smaller tent in the bottom of the bag. But oh no, it's a Buzz Lightyear tent. But not to worry, Alan is happy to sleep in that for
now. Sleeping vessel of a child. I did also enjoy... Because in the book, he writes, after 4 hours of trying, I nearly wrote crying then, brackets, which I did do, actually.
Anything more before we move on to today is 2 day, i.e. day two of my walk?
Nope.
Chapter 11. 2 day is 2 day, i.e. day two of my walk.
Accuracy over brevity once again.
Yep. Yes.
Would you like the day two walk stats?
I'm going to throw to Tom Dark to get the day two walking stats. Tom Dark, have you got those?
I'll tell you what, I'll give you the day two walking stats. On day two, Alan covers 14 miles. He goes from Newton Flotman to Diss.
So a bit more respectable then in terms of coverage.
I think that is nothing to be sniffed at, 14 miles a day. Yeah. Fair play.
Reasonable.
So Alan has slept in a child's tent for the night, or described as an alien fetus, with an Alan emerging from a birthing sack. I would be quite keen to see Alan sleeping in a Buzz Lightyear tent, or to be honest, any grown man sleeping out in the open in a Buzz Lightyear tent.
It kind of reminds me of it's not a tent, but when Ace Ventura comes out of the rhino's arse.
Is it very reminiscent to me of the episode of Sunny in Philadelphia where an oiled nude Danny DeVito comes out of a sofa that he's been sewn into.
I was exactly thinking of that. So you're kind of talking about a fully grown man emerging from a tent. What about a fully grown man that might maybe go to a music festival and can't find their tent and ends up sleeping outside on the floor? Has anyone ever done that? Question to the group.
I mean, I've certainly been to a festival with someone who has.
I mean, I know I haven't.
No,
Tom.
Same.
So, I mean, Jed? No, it's... Nick!
I know what you're probing for here, and yes, in 2016 I did cycle Land's End to John O'Groats
naked
for charity.
Naked.
I didn't do it naked. So yeah, charity is a big thing for me, but I don't like to talk about it much. But thanks guys for recognising it. It's a nice opportunity.
Basically, and then what happened at 2000 Trees Festival in 2017?
Yeah, I mean, all I would say is if you are going to attend a future edition of 2000 Trees Festival, do lock your tent after you get inside it for fear of a lost, confused and drunk Nick Older attempting to sleep in your porch at 3 a.m.
He had a really great time.
Just a really good time. It's at this point that Alan gives his first sensible piece of advice and suggests that people should pack an electric toothbrush, which I wholeheartedly agree. Quickly want to go around the group. Does everyone use an electric toothbrush? Keen to weed out those that are still on manual.
Electric.
I'm electric at home, but manual for travel.
Agree.
I am a manual.
Oh, disgusting.
And your like bamboo nonsense.
Bamboo toothbrushes, because I am pro environment. The environment is good. Well done. Planet Earth is good.
A controversial stance. What are the baffled Nick into silence?
No. I've got a question.
What Capitalist
the,
Nick.
What are the bristles made of?
Bamboo.
You
absolutely bamboozled.
100% recyclable. Okay. Made from recyclable materials.
Okay. Yep. Fine. So you brush your teeth with a bit of bamboo like a panda.
Sounds great.
And you brush your teeth with hardened oil that's been made into plastic.
What do you brush your teeth with then?
The same. I'm just saying. I'm just saying it's not
that
unusual.
If you break it down, look, all I'm saying is I'm pro Earth. Nick is very much big business, big oil.
I got a keep cup this year, so you can rack off, bouncer.
I'm drinking from a keep cup right now.
And you were the last of the four of us to get one as well. Yep.
We've also missed where he misreferences Buzz Lightyear, saying Infinity, the final frontier.
So Lynn has offered to Sherpa for Alan, which I thought was very nice of Lynn.
I wonder, though, has she offered or has she not been given a choice in the matter?
I think she has offered, to be fair. I genuinely think
she probably would, wouldn't she?
Yeah, she has.
Like a little mouse.
Despite being female and 70. Lynn is 70.
She's shattered.
Oh, God. Although, Alan, I'm actually surprised that Alan says no, which sounds like a nice thing on the face of it, but actually it transpires that he got her to carry some microwave ovens up a flight of stairs. So perhaps he's not quite the gentleman.
Sorry, little detail I missed, multiple microwave ovens as well.
Yeah.
Multiple, brilliant.
Yeah.
How many does one need?
I don't know, but I reckon that I would struggle to carry multiple microwave ovens. Yeah. Also, why?
Exactly.
What was the setup for that?
Can I talk a little bit about the reference to laser questing in here?
Yes, please.
My entire body is a hurt zone, a laser questing term for when you find yourself diving for cover, but then the others find you anyway and jump on you.
Did anyone look this up?
Yes, I did. I didn't find hurt zone as a legitimate term, but no. there are a set of terms that are specific to laser questing.
It's exactly that.
Oh, really?
I stumbled on a massive Reddit thread which doesn't have hurt zone.
Did you find spocking?
I can't remember. The list was massive of all these like strategy and military like maneuvers. And
I am staggered. This is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to explain spocking. That's my favourite of the terms. It's basically much like the live long and prosper hand symbol, the Vulcan hand symbol. You basically move your fingers into a V shape over the laser so that you can fire, but crucially not be hit yourself.
Isn't that known as cheating?
Yes, it's a cheating move. Yeah. Also, Laser Quest founded in 1989. Just thought I'd throw that in there.
Thanks, Adam. So Alan insists at this point that he's going to jettison everything apart from the essentials and basically get FedEx to deal with his pack daily. So at this point, I thought it might be useful just to have a quick recap. So to be clear, by day one, he didn't cover the ground that he wanted to, falling short of his initial targets. After night one, he failed to erect his tent and ended up sleeping in a Buzz Lightyear tent. By day two, he's offloading his pack and essentially now just going for a walk. And he's also decided that he's not going to camp anymore.
Fantastic.
So it's going great at this point.
So that's the thing. Do you think it's inferred that he probably set out a rule for himself that he was going to camp every day of the walk and then abandoned that within 2 days?
Yeah, basically.
And isn't the detail about the FedEx arrangement as well, the fact that Lynn has to hand deliver to FedEx? So it's like, what's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Why not just get Lynn to just drive from place to place?
So it's breakfast time or cookie. Does anyone call it cookie, by the way?
No. That's not a thing, is it?
No,
that's
just
make that
Alan thing.
Yeah.
He also suggests that breakfast was invented in the war. I mean, there's quite a lot on the internet about the breakfast and where it kind of stems from, but it's essentially an Anglo-Saxon tradition that goes back to the 13th century, apparently. But the good news is the breakfast provides an excellent segue into Gary Wilmot's wedding. Always keen to hear more about Gary Wilmot.
Keen to hear more because you don't know who he is.
Tell me more.
That's not my fault that I didn't know who he was, though.
I know who he is now.
Oh, I know who he is.
Is he a footballer?
I thought he was. So yeah, just a nice segue into his wedding with his wife, Joanne, although his actual wife is called Sarah, so factually not correct.
Whoa, you've done some actual research.
Yeah, you know. I went onto Gary Wilmot's Wikipedia, and reading it, I did think it had a bit of a Partridge ring to it. See what you think of this this little chapter. Mm-hmm. Although Gary wasn't born into show business, his father was the bass voice that sung the unforgettable line, "I am a mole and I live in a hole," close brackets.
Unforgettable.
Yeah. He had no early ambitions for the stage. However, he had always shown talent to entertain, and so, with encouragement from those around him, he took his first step on the road to stardom. Innumerable guest appearances on television culminated in several of his own TV series gaining him a national star profile. I just thought that was had a slight kind of Alan ring to it.
If this Wikipedia entry doesn't have needs verification at the top of it, then the whole system is broken.
Yeah,
that basically reads like a press release.
Yeah. Last edited by G. Wilmot.
Is there an in popular culture section where it's referenced that he's talked about in Alan Partridge books?
I'm not going to lie, I didn't look, although it wasn't an overly detailed entry, so I doubt it. Alan talks about all the different items that that he had at Gary Wilmot's wedding, including limp pork slices, which personally, I don't know where you stand on this, but one, is it back or is it streaky? And two, is it crispy or is it limp? I would say it's back.
Crispy,
and
crispy, crispy.
It's back, smoked, crispy.
Either any, but it has to be crispy.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say I'm okay with.
Are you a limp pork cylinder?
And it can be damp. Pork fan.
It can be floppy and wet.
But are these dating app names again?
Yeah, yeah. But I don't. I the fat should either be rendered or just, you know, removed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Very important. Yeah. Gary's got similarly stringent guidelines. He doesn't believe in having pre-cooked items being kept warm under catering bulbs, saying, I spend my life on stage under lights. I wouldn't wish that on a sausage.
Yeah.
I mean, fair point.
Again, just further unnecessary detail. Obviously, it's great, but further unnecessary detail about the breakfast having, brace yourself, guys, two types of mushrooms, portobello and a button. Alan opted to take both.
Question to the group. Do you think a cooked breakfast as a wedding buffet option or wedding dinner option is a terrible idea? Or do you think it's not actually that bad?
I think it's pretty bad, but if you put it on the morning after a wedding, you would be the absolute belle of the ball.
That is very true.
Yeah.
Bit novelty, but I don't think it's awful. I think I've definitely had worse wedding food than a cooked breakfast.
Maybe it depends, because some people have quite early wedding ceremonies. So say if you have like a midday ceremony and then you could make that more of a brunch type vibe, that could work.
Better still, get married at 6 a.m. and have the breakfast as your reception.
It's a solid plan.
Yeah. I absolutely love this bit where the joke, inverted commas. So it says that Alan makes an observation, by his words, not even a joke, that the mushrooms look like a duck and her ducklings that have been turned into fungus, at which point, apparently, Gary roared, his words, like, did he? That's barely even a joke.
No way.
Yeah, and then immediately Gary gives him a slot within the speeches to relay that joke, which, again, just doesn't... It seems like an odd thing to lie about, because why would you? It seems like an honest admission, but equally... Why would Gary Wilmot do that?
I think it goes one of two ways. I can believe in the world of the APU that Gary Wilmot is relatively easily pleased. I mean, he's invited Alan to his wedding. Well, he's invited Alan to his wedding and given him a plus one, we find out on the following page.
Yeah.
But even so, I think it's not a good joke.
I mean, if Alan is to be believed, it's at the point in the speech where Gary's saying how beautiful his wife looks, at which point he throws to Alan to make that joke about the mushroom. Looking like fungus, but yeah. Alan basically fumbles the gag, a bit like me in this podcast, to be honest. and the jokes are lost on everyone, a bit like me on this podcast.
It's essentially the point that if you take the setup that Alan and Gary are firm friends, they're both idiots.
Right. Okay. So Gary Wilmot is an idiot, according to you,
in the APU.
Fine. Okay. Got you. So we find out as well that Alan's plus one is Sue Cook, She has reduced John Stapleton to tears. She can't cook, but she will sue. That is the summary of Gary Wilmot's wedding. And I, for one, was glad that we got a little more insight into Gary and his wedding.
I also like when he's talking about taking Sue Cooker's as plus one, that that he's decided he could use the end of his marriage as leverage to get close to Sue, when obviously, were he still happily married, he wouldn't need the leverage, would he?
Yeah.
And clearly a candle has burned for Sue for a long time in Alan's world. Yeah.
Alan is now in the local cafe for his breakfast, Denby's.
His cookie,
which for some reason he presumes is family run, although has absolutely no knowledge of it being so. Again, if Alan is to be believed, this menu is genuinely a bit baffling. So you've got the mega breakfast, the double mega, the king, the best, and the double best. I mean,
you do get a lot of cafes that are like that, though, don't you? Goliath plus, Goliath vegan, you know, like
Goliath 2, this time it's Goliath.
Exactly.
It's the sort of thing where it's like, if you can eat our gutbuster breakfast in 20 minutes, you can have it for free. You're on that sort of place, isn't it?
I do like a little step back, the bit about Rick Stein. As a lover of all things Rick Stein, I like it, the bit where Alan goes, it's like when Rick Stein visits cheap local restaurants run by grannies and pretends the food is as good as proper restaurants.
Delving even deeper into the Denby's experience, there's a slight set to with the owner.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah. And at this point, Alan decides that it would be a good idea to apply deep heat within the cafe, which, if anyone's used deep heat, will know that, seriously, it stinks.
It really does.
And it takes a bit of a dark turn. I'm not sure how we feel about this, but I think this is a slightly dark moment in the book where Alan falls, in his words, utterly in love with one of the waitresses. Does anyone have any comments or thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I love the way that this is another one of those condensed stories where he could have actually gone into a lot more detail about what happens, much like his altercation with Tony Cloak earlier. Because, yeah, in the book, this is literally covered by... there's a brief incident not relevant to the journey, although if you must know, I spotted a waitress there, fell in love with her, utterly in love, stayed in the cafe most of the morning so that I could just be near her, told her how I felt. She didn't want to know. We had a chat, bit of a cry, her dad got involved, and we agreed to leave it there.
God.
This is another example. I mean, obviously, I think it's safe to say we're big fans of this book in general, but this is another bit of the book where it's so visual that I think it would really have worked as some kind of visual, you know, in some kind of visual medium, either as a proper series or a special or something like that. There's so much stuff in here that you can mine for like proper visual gags that I think it would really have worked as a TV show.
Do you mean something like that could be like a montage where he's trying to like gloss over it or something?
Yeah. Imagine a montage with no music, just sort of clattering of background cafe noise and like the hours tick by and it's just him getting furtive glances at her. Yeah, it absolutely would work, wouldn't it?
The fact that she involves her dad, the fact that she ends up crying for me is just like...
I don't think she ends up crying. I think it's him who ends up crying. That's how I read it.
Okay.
Especially as he's described it as bit of a cry, which is fine. How he likes to downplay his own distress.
Can we at least agree then, though, that she's probably quite young if her dad's got involved?
God, yeah.
Yes. Which I just think is the dark turn. Bear in mind, he's you know, quite comfortable championing himself as like, you know, successor in the U-tree generation. I think that this is maybe... a slight proof that he's maybe not the saint that he makes himself out to be.
He also described Denby's as a small business that's been run by the same family for decades. This is a guess, but I think perhaps it's an educated guess based on the fact that both daughter and father work at Denby's together.
So what, the dad is actually...
Mr. Denby.
Mr. Denby that he tried to explain a vignette to earlier.
I think he's trying...
He's already pissed off with it.
Yeah, because he's put deep heat everywhere.
He's cracking onto his daughter.
He's become emotional from Denby's fifth best breakfast and an overdose of deep heat, and he's tried to claim a Denby daughter.
Chapter 12, Flint. Tom, can I throw to you, or is this not applicable in this chapter?
There is no progress to speak of in this chapter.
Okay, fine. So Flint is the spin-off from the could still be a smash hit Swallow.
It could put Norwich on the map.
It could.
Why would I want to do that?
Good point.
Yeah.
Swallow was also covered in iPartridge, wasn't it?
Yes.
As well. It was in the Tony Hares meeting and it was fleshed out in iPartridge.
Exactly. Okay. And this is essentially the Flint equivalent. I don't know what anyone else thinks, but the distinctions between Swallow and Flint appear to be incredibly surface level. Like, there isn't actually much of a difference between the two. So Swallow is obviously the ITV1 show, with Flint being the spin-off that can occupy ITV2. And he describes it as pure ITV2. I genuinely don't know what that means, but I did enjoy the fact that he is prepared to bend to advertisers by putting it in the colour palette of Foxy Bingo.
A key advertiser for the station.
Yeah. I think this says to me that Alan is prepared to satisfy advertisers.
I won't bore you with the details and then spends four and a half pages and a whole chapter going into the details.
Oh, yeah, because this book is about my father, not my drama portfolio. Yeah,
but here we go. Yeah.
Strap in.
Yeah. Excellent use of an APU, which in itself was stolen from the MCU, but a universe-style environment where Flint and Swallow kind of occupy the same sort of environment. I was a big fan of that.
Look, it's Flint. Yeah.
So let's break this down. Flint's basically widowed himself by drunkenly lighting a cigar and then falling asleep in bed, completely or seemingly unaware that half of the bed was burning.
just one half,
and he was able to sleep through that. And then in the morning, his wife isn't there, and the big twist is we don't know if she's dead or has escaped, and may never know. That is basically the big question. And this tragedy prompts him to quit his job as a stuntman to become a fireman.
So Alan describes Flint as a late joiner to the force, so he has a lot of life skills that the rest of the brigade lack, but also crucially he's not picked up their bad habits or addiction to pornography. It's very much tarring all firemen, or firefighters, he says, as firemen like to call themselves, with a wide brush.
There is some good news, however, in what is a show that's seemingly littered with tragedy, and that is that he will no longer drink or smoke in bed, something we can all be grateful for. So we don't know if his wife has been cremated or not in the fire. That's obviously one of the big central conceits, and that is going to keep audiences coming back to find out if Flint can ever track down whether his wife escaped or whether she sadly perished in a fire which only consumed half of his bed.
So is the argument here that if she escaped, she either died in this half bed fire, or she woke up, realised that his cigar had lit her side of the bed on fire, and was so annoyed that she left him never to come back?
Essentially, yes. Right. She didn't even try to put the fire out. She just ran out of the house, never to return.
Not worrying that it might burn her husband, but luckily it stopped at the halfway mark of the bed. Is that what we're led to believe?
Yeah, I think we can all agree that Alan's firmed up a really solid storyline here.
Oh, there's absolutely no holes in it, despite the fact that he goes on to say that Flint will often mistake his wife for strangers or a red setter dog.
There's a very long descriptive passage about how Flint keeps himself in shape as well, more of Alan's sort of thinly veiled admiration of the male form.
Yes, that gets very homoerotic, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Indeed.
Hardly any droop to his body whatsoever. Broad shoulders, supple rather than bulky, lithe. Observers will glimpse the odd ripple in his forearms, but they're arms that suggest muscle rather than boast it.
Well, what I'd say at this point is I have got a quiz that I thought I would furnish you with. How do we feel about a little Flint quiz?
Strongly in favour.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so before we wrap up, I have a Flint quiz to give you, but does anyone have any final comments before we go to that?
Well, I just liked a few more details that Alan puts forward about the show, that sometimes, upsettingly, Flint will make out his wife's face in the flames of a barbecue or on a slice of burnt toast and do a double take. And the idea about viewers seeing the crossover between Flint and Swallow, exclaiming, "Shit, look, it's Flint," or "Shit, look, it's Flint drinking bourbon and looking at the fireplace with wet eyes." And just another little kind of dig at ITV2 at the beginning of the chapter, when he's talking about the colour palette of Foxy Bingo, saying about ITV2, this might just be my imagination, the volume will be higher by quite a lot. Has anyone else ever experienced that those, particularly a channel like ITV2, the moment you get to an ad break, because the way they condense the audio on the adverts, they actually do feel like they're louder.
Oh, I thought you meant because old people watch it, so they have to turn the volume up because they've got bad hearing.
Old people aren't watching ITV2.
No, that's ITV4.
Yeah, you're right.
I think that's a known thing on all ad breaks, is they boost the volume because they know people will be in the kitchen making a cup of tea and they still want them to play Foxy Bingo. Yeah.
Just a quick question to the group. Any thoughts on who would play Flint in a TV version?
Well, I can see your suggestions, and I'm about to explain why you're bang wrong.
Oh, really? So yeah. my suggestions would be possibly someone like Colin Firth or Sean Bean.
Yeah, I think. I mean,
please, I like Bean as an idea.
Please
That's
remember,
good.
This is a low budget ITV2 property, so you might get Bean, you'll never get Firth.
Yeah,
I'm thinking very much more a post Line of Duty rebadged Neil Morrissey.
Yeah,
that's good.
Although, no, he's in good shape.
More strikingly handsome. Though. I think Bean, someone a bit younger with more rippling muscles.
Yeah, someone like, I think Bean is a good option.
I think Jed's putting himself forward.
Oh, God.
It's just one word.
I think Paul McGann. This has Paul McGann.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. McGann could be good, yeah.
One of the McGanns, maybe.
Jed, that's a good shout.
Madeline.
Jed is a good shout, but I am annoyed that you've gone over your word limit yet again.
It's just so unprofessional.
I can think of lots of people it's not good enough for.
Strap in.
It's certainly not John Sim. If someone's looking for a change of tack, not Neil Morrissey, but Martin Clunes.
He's busy filming Doc Martin.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Sim's a bit too young, I think. Oh, he's nearly 50 and Flint's in his 50s. So
Sim's too good for this. Sim is basically ITV1 for
Sim
life at this point.
Sim is pure ITV1.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we ready for the mini quiz?
Yes.
Okay. Why is it only a mini quiz? Can't we have a full quiz?
No, it is quite mini.
Okay, mini quiz then.
So I struggled a little bit in terms of what the quiz should be about, because obviously it's going to be about Flint, but you obviously are pretty well versed in Flint. Bear in mind, you've heavily researched this book, so you're completely familiar with
it. Oh, I mean,
we're
professional broadcasters at this point. Yeah.
So in theory, you're going to smash this, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out a line, and as mentioned earlier, Swallow does feature in a chapter of I, Partridge. So all I'm going to do is read out a line. Is it a reference from one of the two books about Swallow or Flint?
Okay, clear? So do you want a group consensus on this? Or
I think for the sake of ease and sanity, let's just go for a group answer.
Yeah. Okay. So you want Swallow or Flint?
Correct.
Let's play.
Okay. He has a restless mind. Even in his downtime, he has to occupy himself.
I think that's Swallow.
I think that's Swallow.
It's Swallow. He's a keen gardener, cook, and birder.
I think that's Swallow.
I think that's Swallow as well.
Yeah. It's Swallow. He has no middle fingers on one hand.
Swallow.
It's Swallow.
Can I just take a guess? Are they all Swallow?
No. his friend is Chan.
His friend is Swan.
Swallow.
Jan.
Swallow.
Swallow.
It's Swallow.
You sure then?
Oh, Chan.
Swallow?
I thought you were saying Jan.
No, Chan. Chan. Right. Like 4chan or 8chan. That's a thing.
Yeah.
Well, 8chan's not a thing at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Good
topical.
Point.
Topical.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
It goes without saying the show will look terrific.
Could be either.
Well, could be either. Good
I'm going to go with Flint.
I think it's still Swallow.
Oh, really?
Guys, I need an answer.
I'm going to go Swallow. Let's go Swallow.
Is it so Swallow?
Yeah.
Correct.
Oh.
But you're sure these aren't all Swallow?
Correct. He's busted a jewelry racket sky high.
Oh, that is Flint.
No.
Oh, no, that's Swallow.
That's Swallow. Swallow solves crimes.
That is Flint.
Oh, thank you very much.
Fair.
Booger.
He's an outsider, but he kind of likes it that way.
Oh, that could be either.
Mm. Flint.
I would say Swallow, but happy to go in the majority.
Swallow.
It's Flint.
Oh.
He tracks down hoax 999 callers.
That's Swallow.
Gotta be.
Swallow.
It's Flint.
Oh, sorry.
Shit, look, it's...
Swallow.
Flint.
It's Flint.
Oh.
He has a self-destructive streak, always hurting those he gets too close to.
I think that's Flint.
Well, Flint did burn his own wife, so... Yeah?
Flint?
Go with the majority.
Swallow.
What are you saying? Which one are you saying?
Swint.
Follow?
Help me out, guys.
Swallow.
It's Flint.
Ah.
And as no one was keeping track of the scores, we don't know how well he did.
No, we scored 6.
Well done. You've got 6 points.
Out of how many was it?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, my God.
It was out of 10.
Oh.
6 out of 10.
So well done, great. You got 6 out of 10.
I'll take it.
Unfortunately, at 7, it unlocked a prize which involved Jed doing a quick dance for you, but you've not unlocked that.
I think that's fine.
It can't happen. Yeah,
I can unlock that for the change in my pocket, so it's fine. So that brings us to the end of this episode of Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, please do. Nomad theories and general Partridge queries, all welcome. ThePartridgePod@gmail.com is our email address. Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod. Twitter, we're at ThePartridgePod. Instagram, at Monkey Tennis Pod. Or the Monkey Tennis hotline is open for voicemails and WhatsApp voice notes, 07923 600 017. We'll be back with another instalment from the saga of Nomad next week. Until then, thanks so much and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Plop one on him, Knowlesy.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
The total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker.
Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.